So I brought you another haiku this morning. This is from earlier this autumn. Time blowing through the leaves, green, golden, gone. Time blowing through the leaves, green, golden, gone. Okay, well, let's go ahead and get started on the talk. Oh, we have a second screen now. Who's on the second screen? Hello, everyone. If we didn't greet you when you came in, hello. So, okay, we are still looking at right mindfulness here. Last week, Suze gave us a very nice introduction to this topic, and I just had to laugh because I think it was almost the very first thing that you said was word for word the first thing I wrote down when I started taking notes a few weeks ago about mindfulness, and that is mindfulness is a big deal. Yes. The Buddha said mindfulness is the direct path to liberation. That is definitely a big deal. And mindfulness is also a really big teaching. The Satipatthana Sutta, which is the mindfulness sutta, is a big teaching. It is too much to cover the whole thing in 30 minutes. It just is. Like Suze, I have been rereading Joseph Goldstein's book called Mindfulness, and I highly recommend it if you have not read it. It's the whole thing. He goes into great detail. He's very clear, and it's a really good resource. If you just want to read the sutta, you can Google it. You can Google Mindfulness Sutta, and it will come up, and then you can read it. Anyway, today, since I can't possibly cover the entire thing in 30 minutes, I'm going to focus on the things that have struck me as I went through all of this again. So, a few weeks ago, I was sitting here in my living room reflecting on mindfulness, and I remembered when I first encountered the concept of doing something mindfully. And this was years ago when I was living in Quebec. I was, as some of you know, I was living on 100 acres belonging to some friends in an old farmhouse, and I had built a little cabin, a little retreat cabin for myself in the woods. And I had been meditating for just a couple of years at that point, and I was reading a lot of books by various spiritual teachers from various traditions. And one of them, it might have been Thich Nhat Hanh, not sure, but was writing about eating an orange mindfully. And I thought, oh, and he described it in detail and being grateful for where the orange came from and all of this. And I thought, what a great idea. So I happened to have some oranges, so I stuck one in my pack for to go with my dinner, and off I went to my cabin. It was winter, very snowy. So I got into the cabin, I started the fire, and then I sat down to eat my orange mindfully. So I really focused on peeling the orange and the fragrance and then the taste of the orange. And I realized that I also had this peripheral awareness of other things in my environment, like how it felt to be sitting on my cushion or the snowy branches outside my window, and the warmth of the fire. And then I realized that I really needed to put another log in the fire. So I got up to do this mindfully, right? Picking up the log, opening the stove, in it goes. And then I'm looking at my little pile of firewood in the cabin. And then I'm thinking about my big piles of firewood outside the cabin and thinking, yeah, I have enough for the winter. And pretty soon I'm thinking, but do we have enough for the house? And what if we have to cut again and it's just too snowy? And I was gone. That was it. The mind was gone. And so I'm sitting here in my living room, remembering all of this and realizing that what took my mind away was the association, the wood there associated with the wood at the house. And at that moment, I smelled something in my kitchen, and I went running into my kitchen, and I had left a pan on the stove and burned it, contemplating mindfulness. So that, my friends, is a snapshot of the human mind. Now, since then, I have realized that there's a lot more to mindfulness than I realized. And just the four foundations of mindfulness, which are the things we're supposed to be mindful of, is too much to cover in 30 minutes. In fact, Steve Wilhelm, one of our teachers here, spent an entire day on it yesterday. And his talks will be online in a week or two. I highly recommend them. It's quite good. Anyway, I will just briefly mention the four foundations of mindfulness. First of all, we are to be mindful of the physical body, the breath, the posture, actions performed by the body, etc. There are the feeling tones, the vedanas they're called, the feeling tones of experience as our senses make contact with the world and we register things as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. There are the mental states, like greed, hatred, delusion. And then there are what's called the dhammas, with a small d. These are mind objects. This refers to the contents of the mind. And there are several sublists in this category, like the five hindrances, the six sense doors, etc. So I really urge you, if you haven't already, to take a deeper dive into the four foundations of mindfulness. And when I first read the mindfulness book by Goldstein, I remember thinking, oh my goodness, that is so complicated. How will I ever remember this? And I was like thinking of it as this checklist, right? I sit down, okay, I'm aware of the body, check. I'm aware of the mind, check. But of course, it doesn't really work like that. What it has done, though, I notice is it has really expanded the field of my awareness to have, you know, dived into this so that when things come up, I see them. I'm more likely to see them and identify them. Oh, there's greed. Oh, there's unpleasantness, you know. So I also was struck by something I read that Goldstein said, that there are two types of mindfulness. There's spontaneous mindfulness, just arises spontaneously. I think this happens more for children than it does for adults, at least in this culture, I know. But there are times, like walking in nature, perhaps, listening to music. I'm thinking of Suze's symphony, or playing music. I play music. Sometimes when we are just there, so we're just present, you know, spontaneously. But I think more often for us, for me anyway, it's cultivating mindfulness, intentional mindfulness. And so how do we do this? Well, we practice. We sit down to meditate and we focus on the breath. And we are aware of the breath. And we are also aware as the mind slips away and we bring it back to the breath, etc. And we also can practice it in our daily lives. We can say, I am going to see if I can brush my teeth mindfully. That is a big accomplishment for me when I can do it, because my mind tells me that brushing my teeth is boring. But when I actually focus on it, it really isn't, you know. Or maybe I can clean the kitchen mindfully. Maybe I can put a pan on the stove mindfully, And remember, it's there. So anyway, in order to cultivate mindfulness, we need to cultivate the necessary mental qualities. And there are three of these. Sue's also talked about these last week. The first one is ardency. And I will say a little bit more about that in a minute. The next one is clearly knowing. Well, that's pretty obviously. Clearly knowing what is going on, but also clearly knowing the purpose and the benefits of our actions. And then the third one is being free from the desires and discontent vis-a-vis the world. Now, I cannot say that I am always free of desires and discontent, but I can still be mindful because I can be mindful of the desires. I can be mindful of the discontent. And if I can just even manage to do that, then I begin to free myself. That's the first step. And there is an aspect of remembrance involved, remembering the teaching, remembering when we were mindful, what it feels like. And for me, just remembering that mindfulness is an option. That's what I'm working on right now. Mindfulness is always an option. Okay, so as far as ardency or ardor is concerned, for some reason, and I have read this book, Goldstein's book, twice before. This is my third time through it. And I just read right past it the first two times, but this time it stopped me cold. And I thought, ardor, wow. And then I looked up synonyms for it, and I found warmth, the feeling, fervor, passion, intense devotion, enthusiasm. And Goldstein says, it's what gives us the strength to continue on the path. Ardor. The reason it stopped me is because I was used to thinking of spiritual ardor relating to other paths, not Buddhism. I was thinking of Buddhism as the middle way, right? More rational, more contained or something. I was used to thinking of it in terms of, oh, say in Hinduism, the story of Radha and Krishna. Krishna, one of the many avatars of the god Vishnu. He's the divine on earth, and Radha is the milkmaid who loves him and longs for union with him, and he returns her longing, and this symbolizes the longing of the human for union with the divine. It's a very passionate, very ardent story. Or in mystical Christianity, St. John of the Cross talking about Christ as the bridegroom, right? Or in Sufism, the Sufi poets Rumi and Hafiz speaking of Allah as the beloved. That was my idea of spiritual ardor. And here we have the Buddha saying we have to be ardent about mindfulness. I'm thinking, well, that is very interesting. How do we do that? Well, there's always an answer, right? There's always a list of answers. There are reflections that help arouse ardor. First of all, we can reflect on the purpose of the path, the preciousness of the Dharma. And I'm thinking, well, I definitely feel gratitude. I definitely feel appreciation. But does it rise to the level of ardor? And then I thought, well, if ardor is what keeps us going, I'm not quitting. 35 years and counting, I haven't quit. I must have some ardor there. Okay, so the next thing that we can reflect on is impermanence. And I thought of an experience I had last spring. We were having an incredible sunset. The sky, the western sky, was just filled with these coral clouds, and I was transfixed. I just stood there and I watched as it got brighter and brighter, and this golden light around the clouds, and then as it gradually began to fade. And When it was over, I wrote the following haiku. Coral clouds of sunset, beautiful because they fade. Beautiful because they fade. If that were there all the time, I wouldn't even notice it, right? But they do fade. And it seems to me that understanding that makes it possible for me to fully and ardently experience the beauty or the sadness or whatever it is of the moment, and then with the same ardor, let it go. And the third reflection is on karma. Okay, so when I was a kid in Presbyterian Sunday school, I was told that if I was a good girl, I would go to heaven. And if I was not a good girl, of course, the other place. Now, I knew there were consequences for my actions because I had experienced consequences from my parents and from teachers, but I kind of thought there were only consequences if I got caught. Now, I was being told that I would always get caught because God was watching. And it kind of reminded me of the song about Santa Claus, where he sees you when you're sleeping, he knows when you're awake, he knows if you've been bad or good, so be good for goodness sake, right? And so that was a little creepy, but that was kind of the reality or the thought I lived with for quite a few years there. And then when I was a teenager, I decided to read the Bible. That's the kind of kid I was. And so I started with Genesis, and I read all the way through to Revelations, and I learned a lot. I learned, for one thing, I learned that most of the Bible is incredibly boring. But I also found some of it very interesting. And one thing I found interesting was in the Gospel of St. Luke, when Jesus says, "The kingdom of heaven is within you." And I said, "Within me? That's not what I learned in Sunday school. I don't think so." And so I contemplated that for a long time, and till I began to understand through experience that what I put out comes back to me. I create my own inner heaven or hell. And of course, my understanding of karma grew more sophisticated, I suppose you'd say, as I started learning more about yoga, more about the whole theory of the whole law of karma. And I think that keeping this understanding front and center, that we own our actions, they create our inner reality. I think it's so important and it's so vital that it gives rise to an ardent urgency to be free, right? So then I'm thinking, okay, how do I want mindfulness ardently without it turning into clinging? Because there is such a thing as spiritual clinging. We all know that. We want a certain result and we grasp for it and we become tense and it goes farther away. And I think that this is kind of a habit we have because we are, we're associating our spiritual goals with the way we approach our worldly goals, where we are grasping at something that we don't have, a job or a possession or a relationship or some outcome that we can't really control. And so there's this tension and dukkha, suffering, that arises from this grasping. But when we're wanting mindfulness, it's different because mindful awareness is always accessible. It's already ours. It's ours, right? We do have to practice, but we also have to realize we are only ardently wanting what we already have. Mindfulness is always an option. So, in spite of all of the lists and all of the categories, which do expand our understanding, definitely worth reading and learning about, actually practicing mindfulness is simpler than we make it out to be. It is coming back to bare knowing, just simply knowing what's it like right now, without all the constant interpretations and storytelling and complications that the mind likes to add to things. And unfortunately, I guess for us, this is not natural to us. It takes right effort to do that. And yet when we do it, it feels natural, right? Okay, so I would like to end with one more episode about Leo the cat, who is turning out to be one of my main teachers these days. And for those of you who missed episode 1 and 2, Leo is this lovely black tuxedo cat, 15 years old, who lives right up there in the apartment above me. And his people, his mom and dad, I will call them, frequently hire me to take care of Leo when they go away. Now, Leo still lives up there. I still live down here. But I go up and I feed him and I let him in and out. And he loves to go out. And I often don't know where he is, which those of you who heard episode 1, you know that has caused me some anxiety. But anyway, last week, they asked me if I could keep Leo Thursday through Sunday, because they were going out of town. I said, well, I'm going out of town on Thursday, but I will be back on Friday. So if you leave him inside with lots of food, then when I get back on Friday, I'll go up and check on him. So they said, fine, great. So Thursday came, and I was leaving late morning, so I thought, okay, I can do the Thursday morning 9 o'clock sit. So I'm sitting there meditating, and I hear a lot of activity going on upstairs, and they're getting ready to leave, and I hear them going down the stairs and up the stairs and stuff. And my mind starts going, and it starts saying, what if they forget to leave him in? What if they forget I'm not coming back till tomorrow? I'll never find him, and it'll be too cold. He'll freeze, you know. And then I'm thinking, Judith, settle down. They're not going to forget. They're not going to forget. Relax, focus, mindfulness. So I come back into the meditation, and then I hear them go downstairs again, and I'm off. And it's just back and forth. The last 10 minutes of meditation, we're back and forth. So finally, when meditation was over, I had to go get something in my car, and I went out and I ran into Leo's dad, and he confirmed they are indeed leaving Leo inside. So I relaxed, and I went off on my trip, and the next day, when I drove into the parking lot, I was tired, and I was thinking, well, at least Leo is inside. I know where he is. I won't have to look for him, right? So I bring my stuff in, grab their key, go up, go in. Hi, Leo. Leo. Hi, Leo. I don't see Leo, but that's not unusual. Leo is often asleep, and it maybe takes 3 or 4 times calling him. And I know where he tends to sleep. They have a lot of stuff under their bed, stored under their bed. He loves to go in there. So I went into the bedroom. I'm kneeling down. Leo. Hi, Leo. Hi, Leo. No Leo. Okay. So I start going around to all the rooms in the apartment. I'm opening all of the closet doors. What if he got shut in the door, in a closet? And I'm calling him in every single room, and no cat. And I do this for like 20 minutes. No Leo. So I think, you know, what happened? And finally I say, I've got to call them, you know. So I called Leo's mom. I'm standing in their living room, put her on speakerphone, and I say, I've been here for 20 minutes. I can't find the cat. She said, well, I know he's inside. I saw him inside when I left, when we left, and there's no way he can get out. So he's probably just sacked out someplace, just, you know, not waking up. And I said, does he do that? And she said, yeah, sometimes he does, and it's usually he's under the bed. So, you know, just keep looking, and if you don't find him, call me back. So I... okay, so back into the bedroom, turn the flashlight on my cell phone, and I'm, you know, like looking through all the stuff under the bed and calling Leo, and no Leo. So I come back into the living room, and there he is, stretching, yawning, looking innocent. He was somewhere behind the couch, you know. And so, you know, I text her, tell her he's okay, fine, he's here. And then it occurs to me, I wonder if what had finally penetrated his deep sleep was the sound of her voice, you know, like, "Mom's home." I don't know. He can't tell me. But anyway, I fed him and came downstairs. And so I am reflecting on this experience and thinking, okay, was I mindful during this at all? Definitely there was agitation in the mind. And what ifs kept coming up? What if he's sick? What if he's dead? What if he did escape, you know? There was also definitely an attachment to a certain result, finding the cat. But there was also this little voice that kept saying, mindfulness is an option. Mindfulness is an option. And when I heard that little voice, well, the what ifs dissolved. And I was present. I was aware of the agitation, but it kind of kept it at a manageable level. It did not get rid of the attachment to the result, I have to admit. But I also did not do anything stupid, like leaving the pan on the stove. You know, I looked for the cat, I made the phone call, got useful information, and I finally found him. So I would say, okay, if mindfulness is being present and aware, I was pretty present. I was pretty aware. And I also realized mindfulness isn't always necessarily blissful or even pleasant. It's not liberation. It's the first step to liberation. And if what you're being aware of is unpleasant, mindfulness might feel a little bit unpleasant, but it does bring the mind to clarity, and it is the first step to letting go. So overall, I would have to say that that experience did reinforce my conviction that mindfulness is already mine, and it is always, always an option. Okay, thank you for your kind attention. And so now I think we will break into small groups, and I want to say just a bit about that. We have some guidelines for the small groups. Tremaine, I know some of you are going to leave. That's okay. First of all, be respectful. Get everybody a chance to talk if they want to. We're not there to judge anybody. We're there to listen. And we don't need to give advice unless specifically asked for it. This is supposed to be a safe space where we can just share our own experiences. And I would say, if you want a prompt, just think of something in your life that would be a good focus for creating or, in, you know, bringing mindfulness into your daily life. But you can talk about whatever you want that's related. Okay, so I'm going to, let's see, we've got 24 people. That is 8 groups, right? Oh, I'm one of them. So I think 8 groups, right? I'm a math whiz here. Okay. Breakout groups. Okay. Assign automatically. Create 8. Okay. Open all. Yeah, that looks good. Open all rooms. So hello everyone. I realize I forgot to tell you how much time you had. But I'm sure you adjusted beautifully. So now we have some time for just comments and questions. Anything you'd like to ask, Claire? I think you can unmute yourself.
Thank you. Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes.
This was a great talk. Thank you so much. Really, like, fertile conversation. And what came up, one of the things that came up in the small group was this idea of forgetting things, and how does that relate to mindfulness, and how does that relate to aging? And you know, I asked the question many, many times a couple of years ago to different teachers. Like, I feel like trying to stay in the present time and not like floating away to the past is I'm forgetting things because I'm not rehearsing them. And I don't know. I'm just so curious what other people might think about that.
Yeah, there definitely is a remembrance factor to mindfulness. And as I said, for me, it's just even remembering that it's an option. And of course, I'm not young either, and I totally know what you're talking about the memory. And I think that's the importance of practice, of turning mindfulness into the habit rather than the drifting away into the habit. But it takes a lot of practice. And I find for me, of course, I'm used to doing it during meditation, but to bring it into my daily life and just set something, okay, just this, just brushing my teeth. If I can just be mindful while I brush my teeth, that's a start, and make that a habit, you know, and then you can expand it to other things. But yeah, it does not come naturally to us, especially in this culture. That's not what we're conditioned to do, to be mindful. Yeah. Anybody else have any? Oh, yeah. Hey, Thomas. Yeah.
It's a great question, Claire. I've been pondering that one for a long time as well. And I think what comes to mind is I find myself sometimes if I find myself that my mind is in the future a lot. It's planning the future, it's worrying about the future, problem solving, this and that. And if I sort of am able to go into mindfulness, I sort of end up here and now. Mm-hmm. And focusing on washing my dishes or whatever I'm doing, being in a meeting with other people or whatever's going on. And I often feel that sort of my happiness climbs up because I don't have the worrying, I don't have the planning. I'm here with what I'm doing and it makes me happier. So I feel there's a direct line to happiness. The more mindfulness I can bring into my day, the better day it sort of becomes for me. But it's not easy because I'm very automatically into the planning, the worrying, you know, these things do.
Right.
It takes effort to bring that mindfulness, has been my experience. But curious what other people experience.
Yeah, it definitely takes effort, right effort, right? But it is reinforcing in that way because, I mean, it's just better. It's better to be mindful. It's better to be present, you know. It's better to know that you've got a pan on the stove, you know, that kind of thing. So it does reinforce itself. Okay, Lyndall.
One of the things that this discussion reminds me of is that it's also important to be mindful of the times when, you know, our mind is distracted.
Right.
Or our mind is anxious or our mind is forgetful. So there's that aspect of mindfulness that can sort of know that distracted quality in the middle of the distraction happening in the mind. You know, there's just enough space in it to know that it's there. And so that I think I know I have to sometimes remind myself, and maybe it's good to remind ourselves that being mindful doesn't mean that the mind has to be in this perfect state all the time.
Right.
That what we may be mindful of is hindrances or anger or distraction or forgetfulness or all of that other stuff.
So right, exactly.
The whole ball of wax.
The whole ball of wax. It's like being mindful that my mind was agitated.
Exactly.
But I knew it was agitated. It didn't stop immediately.
But we know it, yeah.
There's but I knew it, part. Yeah.
There's
and
a that, part that's
that
not became, agitated. Yeah.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, thanks. Suze.
But just following up on both Claire's question and Lyndall's comment that that being mindful of the fact that we're forgetful and that we've forgotten a lot of stuff. And then I sit with these two wonderful women on Wednesday morning, and one of them several years ago brought this up, and it just keeps coming back, that forgetfulness isn't a problem. It just is the nature of aging and life. And so then instead of making it into, isn't this awful? Oh, I'm living in a time when I forget a lot of stuff. And I really appreciated your comment about forgiveness earlier. And to just go, oh yeah, once again, you forgot where you put your phone down. Okay, we're going to walk around the house and find it. And it's okay. You know, what else you got to do with your time right now? So there's not making what the state of mind into a problem. It just, this is what's here right now. Anyway, it's been a real gift from this Dharma buddy that I remind myself of a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a really good point. And my friends and I often laugh about our forgetfulness, you know, just have some humor involved with it. Yeah. Candace.
I love that, Suze. I love that. It's okay. It's okay that we're forgetful. That's just how we are. What I was thinking about in our small group was one of the things I really appreciated in the talk was reminding us that, you know, there's the idea of being free of desires and discontent, but what we're really working on is being mindful of our desires and discontent. And that took me to my practice lately of trying not to get too wrapped up in the news, to know when it's time to back away, because I get mindful of how I start behaving when I'm really wound about what I've read about, and that's not healthy. Mm-hmm. So I'm mindful now that at first I was feeling a little guilty about trying to stay away from it a little more. And then I realized, oh no, this is really important practice, because I don't want to bring this energy to everybody else. This isn't good, but it's also good to notice it and to be aware of it. So yeah. And that's the mindfulness part that isn't so pleasant, but it's really a lesson. It really helps us. Thank you for you. You just really fleshed that out for me. That little comment. It was so great. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, I think too, you know, when my first idea of mindfulness was really about being mindful of my actions, peeling the orange, but it's so much more than that. It is being mindful of the mind states, the feeling tones, the whole thing. And it is the first step to awakening. It's not liberation. It is the beginning. It's a necessary step. Yeah. And I this has become my mantra, you know, mindfulness is an option. It is always an option. And I just, it plays like a loop in my mind sometimes, you know. Okay, anybody else? Okay, if not, I do have some announcements here. Yeah, it's about time anyway, isn't it? All right, so on November 22nd, from 9 to 4:30, we will be having a day of mindfulness, a day long, both at the center and online. It's called Understanding Self and Not Self Leads to Freedom. And this will be, four of us, Steve Wilhelm, whom I mentioned yesterday, and Suze and Lyndall and I. Registration is required, and you can find everything you need on the website. On December 6th and 7th, there will be a weekend retreat, 9 to 4:30 Saturday and Sunday, with Philip Moffitt, and he's also will be having a little session on Friday evening from 7 to 9. Registration is required for the weekend, but not for the Friday night. It's called Liberating the Ego, Humility, Dignity, and Integrity, and it is online only. And that weekend, we will not be having this sit because we encourage people to tune into Philip. He's marvelous teacher. We have some introductory meditation classes starting in January. One on the east side, taught by Steve Wilhelm, will be starting on the 21st of January, and Carrie Peterson, one of our guiding teachers, will be starting one in the Seattle Center on the 22nd. They will also be online. Registration is required for that as well. So details on the website. Okay. Anything I have forgotten that anybody can think of? Okay.
I had one thing I wanted to say about our day long on Anatta.
Yeah.
If you want to go, please register sooner rather than later because we're trying to get a sense of how many people will be there. And so if you wait until the very last minute, we may just think there's a few people when actually there's a lot of people that want to participate. So if you're interested, register soon. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Lyndall. Thank you. Very good point. All right, so we have just a couple minutes left. So let's just sit together and let's dedicate the merit of our practice. Okay. So to all of those who are frightened now, and to all of those who are hungry, and all of those experiencing war and other disasters, we dedicate the merit of our practice to you. May you be well. May you be happy. May you be safe. May you be protected and cared for. And may you live with ease. Thank you.